This morning, we have two stories from Scripture about God's mercy and generosity and grace. I imagine you've heard the stories preached before, certainly the manna and the quail that appear for the complaining people in the desert, in the wilderness of sin. Have you ever been in the wilderness of sin? Sounds pretty difficult, doesn't it? Sometimes we're not even aware we're in the wilderness of sin. I understand that most biblical scholars don't quite know where that is or was, but some believe that it was on the eastern shore of the Red Sea or the western shore of Saudi Arabia. I've been there. It's incredibly hot. I can't imagine being in the 45th day of a journey to freedom, which was going to take 40 years, but we didn't know that, having come out of slavery and the malnourished, poor health state that people are in when they come out of slavery, not having enough water, not having enough food. And that's where they came to that wilderness of sin and how not just individual sin, but the complicity of the whole people of God makes it so the world has those places where some people are in the wilderness of sin, that place of loss, of not enoughness more than others. The people are complaining bitterly. Literally, the translation for the word is murmuring. Have you ever had a spouse or a partner or a child who murmurs under their breath? When they're in the kitchen and they're doing the dishes and you're watching TV or something they think is agreeable and they're saying things and you say, I know what you're saying, I can hear you in there. And they just murmur away, you know it's not anything good. You've probably done it yourself. Haven't you walked away from somebody and go, oh, man, you know, I've done it in your car, I'm sure, that kind of murmuring. Bitter complaint. Sometimes that's a strategy of people made poor because it's the only way they can express their complaints is murmuring. But this is the whole community of God. Can you imagine the cacophony of the whole community of God murmuring? I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, you know, we want to go back to slavery. That's a whole lot better. We could have died over there, but we're going to die here in the desert. Why did you bring us here? Why did you even bring us here? The complaint in the story we heard this morning from Exodus is the third of its kind in the book of Exodus. After the Israelites escape slavery, in chapter 13, they turn to Moses asking, were there no graves in Egypt that you must lead us out to the desert to die? What have you done to us? Why did you bring us out of Egypt? Didn't we tell you in Egypt, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians? It would have been better to work for the Egyptians than to die here in the desert. I've known some migrants who've said that, who are thinking they're coming to promised land, a land that was theirs before it was ours, a land that has the possibilities of work and education and a decent life, dignified work. But yet, there they are in the desert on the second or third day when they thought it was only going to take a day, and they're crying out to the coyote, the guide that's taking them across the desert, why did we even come here? I know that some children of migrants who have come through the desert also say, why did you do this? Why did you even do this? We'll talk a little bit more in a bit about circumstantial amnesia, which is what this is. In Exodus 15, verse 24, after the Israelites pass through the Red Sea and they enter the vast desert where they find the water is bitter, they too become embittered and they complain to Moses about their thirst, murmuring. Each complaint follows a certain pattern. First, the people encounter a devastating threat to their well-being. The pursuit of the Pharaoh and his chariots, deadly dehydration, and starvation. They complain against their leadership. When something goes wrong in the church, don't people look at the leader and say, you know, it's her fault or his fault? Isn't that, you know, I was taught when I was a child, if I say, it's Sharon's fault, I have four fingers pointing back at me, so, you know, there's some, I have some stake in that. We complain against our leadership. The third step is their frustrated human leaders bring the complaint to God. Can you please do something with these people? They are driving me crazy. Can you imagine that conversation with Moses and God? I don't know what to do. These people are driving me crazy. And God hears and acts by providing what they need, not necessarily what they want. The miraculous crossing of the sea, the providing drinkable water, and in this narrative, providing meat and bread. The language of the complaint is strong. One might even say that it's unfair. The Israelites said to Aaron and Moses, I don't know where Miriam was, but this was a threesome in the leadership. They gave her a break this day. If only we had died by Yahweh's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat next to pots of meat and ate our bread. So what if the meat was rotten and the bread was stale? So what if it tasted terrible? Our stomachs were full. But now you've brought the whole community out into this wilderness to die of hunger. Although the harsh slavery the people endured in Egypt is described earlier in the chapters of Exodus, bears no resemblance to this description of plenty they claim they enjoyed there. They're remembering the flesh pots and the stale bread, rotten bread that they had as something wonderful. And it wasn't. The people make no mention of Pharaoh and his unreasonable demands. In an indirect way, the people seem to blame God for both their current crisis in the wilderness as well as their enslavement. It's all God's fault. If only we had died by Yahweh's hand in the land of Egypt. Yet Pharaoh was the one trying to kill them in Egypt. It was God who rescued them. Their hunger leads them to something that we can call circumstantial amnesia. It's very convenient. You've probably tried it yourself, right? You've been out of, maybe you hurt somebody's feelings or did something that you wish you hadn't or even suffered something terrible at the hands of another or others. And you get through it and life is good and it's hard to remember. You know, we have this fond nostalgia for the good old days, which doesn't recognize how difficult the good old days were for many of God's people. That circumstantial amnesia can also apply to a dysfunctional family of addiction, alcoholism, abuse, where we say, yesterday was terrible, but today is good. And that's what we have. And people stay in abusive situations because of that circumstantial amnesia. Circumstantial amnesia is also forgetting our own history of how we've oppressed people and enslaved people and done harm to people and keep doing the same things over and over again, even though they weren't effective the last time and the time before that. Circumstantial amnesia can even be, well, I'm fine here. It's a beautiful morning this morning in the desert in Tucson, Arizona. And you know those people who've had 3 earthquakes in Mexico and who are living outdoors and Mexico City's cold? And that was yesterday, and that was a week ago and 2 weeks before that. And it's good right here. That's circumstantial amnesia where we have blinders for what's going on around us, both in time and in space. The Israelites' experience of slavery allowed for no room of originality or constructive interpretation or development, but still the people found a way out of no way, despite severe physical, spiritual, and psychological effects of slavery. And in this passage, they are remembering it fondly. They must have been really, really miserable in the desert. They'd had to develop strategies for survival, coping mechanisms, including murmuring. That kind of gossip, that chattering about him or her or they or whoever it was that did the bad thing in the church or in the family or in the country, would serve them as slaves. But as free people or people trying to get free, it's very conflictive. It is not effective. We might imagine or remember from our own experiences that not everyone embraced the possibility of freedom as did Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. The Jewish Midrash, the stories and poems tell us that some were sore afraid and eager to turn back from the first day, and that others were armed and were finally able to give vent to their rage, and they were all too ready to use their weapons. Still others are said to have been so certain that God would deliver them that they plunged into the Red Sea even before it divided. We know those people in church too, right? Yeah, it takes a village. So you take this mix of people, and it's no wonder that there was discontent. This divisiveness echoes throughout our faith story in today. Circumstantial amnesia is common in individuals and families and faith communities and nations. Why can't we just be nice? Forget what happened a while back there and forget the people that left the church then or whatever was going on. It's good today. Can't we all just get along? Our faith story tells us of a divinity that rather than digging in, responds to the complaints with mercy and grace. God is portrayed as focused on the people and their needs rather than irritated or frustrated, as were Moses and Aaron, by their wants. And we're called to imitate God. Experiences of getting free, of being certain what we want, only to find that what we truly needed was something much different, something that was called forth, some discipline and responsibility and new behavior from us as individuals and a nation. Getting free isn't an event. It's a lifelong process. We take two steps forward, we take one step back. We take two steps forward, we take two steps back. We're always moving forward a little with God and then falling back. The Israelites get to the promised land and they begin to oppress other people and enslave other people and behave in the way that the Egyptians behaved to them. That's who we are as God's people. Getting free as a progressive Christian church, looking at the language that we use in our hymnals, the language that we use in our worship service, opening it up to all the metaphors for God that are in the Bible, makes some people really angry or frightened that they're going to lose some of their privilege and power. When we change our bylaws, when we change our practices to welcome more and more people in, those who've had a comfortable place, that certain pew where they sit, are sometimes very uncomfortable and act out on that discomfort because suddenly they don't have the power and privilege that they had. The people of Israel go from one challenge to the next, and as they fall back, then they're called to let go again and to believe again. Walter Brueggemann, the biblical scholar, writes, "The first task is leaving abusive relationships, abusive settings, and the second is believing." So often people who are in these situations for a long time have lost their faith. Sometimes the first right thing is getting out, and the next piece that follows is faith. And that usually happens in and through God, in God's whole community. Anyone who's been in a 12-step program knows this. First, we need to break the pattern of enslavement, and then we come to believe in a power greater than ourselves, a higher power, God, in and through community. Not God all by God's self up there in the sky, but God in relationship with the whole of community. When God rained down the quail and the manna, the people had to go out and collect it, harvest it, and prepare it. It was a communal activity. God didn't just save the people in our story. The people had to also act to save themselves. This is what the process of freedom is about. We face the same challenges, perhaps in different ways, and God shows up as we face these challenges. It became clear in the story of today, out there in the desolate wilderness, where abundance was hard to see, let alone taste, that life wasn't going to suddenly be easy, and that freedom itself brought with it enormous challenges and responsibilities and sacrifices. We can resonate with the anxiety and fear felt by those Israelites in the stark wilderness in which they found themselves. The times when we're struggling, the times between what was and what might be, those moments when our lives and or the lives of our loved ones require that we change, that we shed our skin and become new. And this is a story of God's whole community, not just individuals. We can identify with the difficulties of getting free from the addictions that have locked us into a culture of consumption and abuse, times when God seems far away and freedom for all God's people seems impossible. Right? Isn't that where we are today? In his commentary on Exodus in the New Interpreter's Bible, Walter Brueggemann draws a distinction between the concerns of those who've reached the promised land and those who were lost and hungry and uncertain in the wilderness on their way. Where for those people in the wilderness, the primary concern is anxiety about survival. In the promised land, the temptation is complacency about self-sufficiency. The story of manna is not for all life. What we need today, what God gives us today, may not be what God gives us tomorrow. It's what we need in order to take our next right step. It's for life in those times, those zones of bereftness when the problem is not self-sufficiency, but abject despair, need, and anxiety. At one time or another, all of us have experienced the zones of bereftness. I think we're in a global zone of bereftness right now. The earth is revolting. The people are revolting. The refugees, the migrants, the wildfires, the huge spasms of our Mother Earth, the hurricanes, zones of bereftness. And God's mercy and generosity continues. The story in Matthew's gospel I want to just visit for a moment is also a story of collective misery. It's a scene in the Bible that reveals what's going on in our world today. So we have the rich landowner, and he pays all of his laborers, day laborers, the same amount, even those that he hires at the end of the day. And when the ones who came first complain bitterly, he says, "This is my money, isn't it? I can do with it what I want." And that's a good thing, isn't it? The justice that they all make the same wage. But we know what happens. When the people who are not hired first begin to get jobs, and they begin to vote, and they begin to be seen in public, and they begin to have some of the same rights as all people have, other people have, then those who've had it for a long time get very, very nervous. What the man does is generous and just, but he doesn't consult the workers. He has a marginalized community of people who have been enslaved in a way, and I think that that's what's happening in our world today. Those who voted for our current president, many of them at a grassroots level, are laborers, and they're people who've been betrayed, and they're people who feel they're losing some of their power and privilege because others suddenly or over some long period of time begin to have them. And then we have people at the very bottom, the migrants, the refugees, the disabled, the mentally and physically ill, the people who look perfectly fine but have some disabling illness. We have people who are left at the end of the day who aren't hired. And that working class, I'm telling you, you can have a civil war over those two factions warring against each other. How do we live into a world that holds God's generosity and grace and mercy and compassion with the fact that we have an economy where there are people who at the end of the day do not have a job, are not employable? They have kids at home that they have to be home with. You know, they have a spouse who's ill that they have to be home with. They are too ill to go to work. All the reasons why people don't have dignified work, don't have work at all at the end of the day. How do we bring those pieces together and build a community for the whole community of God where there's enough for everyone? This is our calling. And when we continue to polarize and demonize and divide, we are living into the destruction of God's whole community. It's only when we see what the systems and structures are doing and how they've been perverted that we can make changes collectively and individually so that all of us are not only welcome to the table, but there's enough for everyone to eat. Amen.